Pretty soon you'll think it's Monday afternoon, it's Friday.
Call the House Health Care Committee to order. Welcome. We're going to change the order a bit because we have Representative Richardson, who deserted our committee to move into more powerful places like the Ways and Means Committee, but has worked very hard on House Bill 2346 and 2347. And I will open a public hearing on those two bills and call Representative Richardson to do this.
Be
perfectly appropriate.
Yeah.
Frank, you want to join us? Sandy,
yes.
Do you just want to give us a brief review on these two bills, please?
Did you open up both of them, Mr. Chair?
I opened both of them, yes.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2346 limits the authority of certain health professional regulatory boards to conduct mental, physical, or competency examinations, assessments, or evaluations to cases in which the board determines if there is objectivity, reasonable basis for believing that the licensee or applicant poses danger to patient safety or their health. It also allows the licensee or the applicant to request a contested case hearing to determine if that board request for a mental, physical, or competency examination, assessment, or evaluation. It also provides exceptions that permits immediate conduct of examination, assessment, or evaluation. House Bill 2347, along the same lines, prohibits a health professional regulatory board from assessing a licensee any attorney fees, investigation costs, hearing costs, or any other costs associated with an investigation or disciplinary proceeding. It prohibits, the prohibition includes any board advisory council or program overseen by the Department of Human Services or the Oregon Health Licensing Agency.
If I may just point out before we get started, for the benefit of the audience, you'll see several of our members with laptops in front of us. We're making a concerted effort to move as paperless as we can. And you'll
we're
find us staring, several of us staring at computer screens, and it's probably not that we're playing poker or looking at pornography. It's probably that we have the bill in front of us rather than the paper copy and reviewing it.
Now, why would you do it then?
I said probably not.
Oh.
Thank you, gentlemen. Would you start, please, Representative?
Certainly. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's a pleasure to be here in front of you to discuss a matter that does not affect my district. I have no dog in this fight. My only involvement is that I'm concerned about assuring that there's due process in the various aspects in which the power of the government can be involved. And it was brought to my attention, it's been over a year ago, that in certain instances, medical boards have the ability to not only conduct investigations, but also to order research, order evaluations, order a number of costs and expenses that will all ultimately be paid by the licensees that are being investigated. And if the licensee were to be unhappy with some of these requirements, then the board also has the ability to either take the license or to do other punitive actions, which certainly chills the ability for a person who feels like they may be wrongly or unfairly accused from actually being able to prove their case, both because of the cost that can be assessed against them and the potential for retaliation. And so in talking with Mr. Musel and others about this situation, it became really apparent to me that there needs to be an outlet for due process, that if a board has power to affect a person's future livelihood, that is similar power to put someone in jail, and that we never would allow the judiciary to be the accuser, the prosecutor, the assessor of fines, and the imprisoner all at the same time. And so that's really what we have in some of the powers that are able to be exercised by the boards. And so I feel it's very important that we make sure that for those rare instances where an accused feels that he's being accused unjustly, that he have the ability to appeal it to an administrative law judge who in a very short amount of time can determine whether or not there is an appropriate whether whatever is being requested or required by the board is appropriate under the circumstances, and in some circumstances it should not be appropriate to charge the accused with all of the board's expenses and, you know, the consequences of their investigation, because that in itself is very chilling. So that's why I'm involved, and I would hope that the committee would very seriously consider moving ahead House Bills 2346 and 2347, because they seek to assure that there is due process and fairness for those that are accused.
Do you have a few moments to hang in?
Certainly.
Mr. Marcel, and then perhaps you can respond to questions. As Vice Chair, I know last session you helped to work on these bills. It was very much appreciated. Mr. Marcel?
Thank you, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee. My name is Frank Musel. Thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony regarding House Bill 2346 and House Bill 2347. I'd like to address House Bill 2347 first, which is the regulatory costs matter. House Bill 2347 repeals the authority of professional licensing boards, health-related professional licensing boards, from imposing their regulatory costs on licensees at the end of a disciplinary proceeding. I'd like to take a minute and give you my background. For 21 years prior to entering private practice 6 years ago, I was an assistant attorney general, and I spent the majority of my time as an assistant attorney general representing and as counsel to the Board of Pharmacy, Board of Nursing, the Board of Dentistry, speech pathology and audiology, occupational therapists, physical therapists, massage therapists, and a variety of other boards and agencies. I provided you with the written testimony that's 7 pages long in regard to this. Appended to that as Exhibit 1 is the list of boards that have the cost power. And third exhibit, the second exhibit, is a 10-page compilation of the data that shows 4 years of agency experience in regard to regulatory costs. Needless to say, I don't propose to come anywhere close to reading that. I'd like to make a number of points. Let me illustrate some of the problems that occur, that have occurred with this power. The first example that I'd like to provide you is the case of the Oregon Board of Chiropractic Examiners, which issued a disciplinary order that required the licensee to pay the board's costs. This was after a full-blown hearing, to pay the board's costs in the amount of $43,503. There is no process, and there was no process provided to that individual to contest that charge. Once that bill was filed, were that bill to have been filed, and it could have been filed with the clerk's office in the county, in any county in Oregon, that order becomes a lien on that person's house and any other real property that that person owns. There is no process, and And one can readily imagine that one would like to have an opportunity to raise a question about the rationale for the imposition of those costs and the validity and the reasonableness of those costs. That's example number one. Example number two is a physician who was charged by the Board of Medicine with incompetent practice was required to submit to 3 days of an unnecessary competency evaluation. She had to bear the multi-$1,000 cost of this unnecessary evaluation. She had to bear the expense of travel to the facility picked by the board in New Jersey. She had to bear the expense of lodging while she was there, and she experienced the loss of income from her practice due to the time out of the office resulting from the board-ordered evaluation. She went through a hearing, had three expert witnesses testify on her behalf, and she prevailed. The board dismissed the case. She ultimately prevailed, but she didn't recover her costs from the board in that case because there is no provision for a person in her circumstance recovering those costs from the board. Another example that I'd like to share with you is a situation where a physician was the subject of an evaluation order, and she proceeded to request, after she received that, she did not submit to the evaluation. She got another evaluation, and when we talk about the evaluations in the other bill, I want to come back and talk about this. But in regard to the costs, is that she made a request for a hearing, and at the conclusion of the hearing, there was a final order that sanctioned her. And after being sanctioned, in addition to that, the costs of that proceeding were imposed on her in the amount of $11,000 and some change. She went to the Court of Appeals in regard to the flawed hearing process that she believed that she'd been subjected to, and she won. The Court of Appeals reversed the final order of the board, remanded the case to the board for further proceedings. She was finally, it appears to me, was finally worn out by this entire process and at the end agreed to settle the case. She agreed to settle the case, and it included a provision that she pay $4,000 of the regulatory cost order that the Court of Appeals had reversed. And the fourth example that I'd like to share with you is a case of an applicant for a licensure with the Board of Medicine who was denied, her application was denied. She went through a contested case proceeding, and at the end of the contested case proceeding, her application was denied by final order, and the board issued a regulatory costs order against her for $4,000 and some change. The board has absolutely no legal authority whatsoever to impose regulatory costs on an applicant who goes through a hearings process. The statute is quite clear that they only have the authority to impose regulatory costs on licensees in a disciplinary case. So those are four cases out of 21 instances where regulatory cost orders have been imposed that illustrate some of the problems with that process. Now, what is the rationale that's been advanced in support of the power to impose these regulatory costs? And the answer is that the rationale is threefold. One purpose given for this power to impose regulatory costs is to punish licensees who have exercised their right to contest the board's charges. Second, this purpose is advanced is that it generates revenue for the board.
Excuse me, Mr. Maselli.
Yes.
Can you help me a moment? Are you referring, are regulatory costs different than costs as defined in the bill for disciplinary proceedings?
No, Chair Greenlee, they're the same. I'm simply referring these to regulatory costs.
But you said there was no there was power to charge one kind of cost but not another?
Thank you. Let me clarify that. It is the difference between an applicant seeking licensure, going through a hearings process, and being denied initial licensure. And in that circumstance, the board has no legal authority to impose its costs of the proceeding in that setting. It only has the authority to impose costs in a disciplinary proceeding against a licensee for violations of the Practice Act and the board's rules.
And the bill is to take away that second, I mean...
The bill is to take...
Power they have.
That's correct, Chair Greenlake. The bill takes away the only actual lawful power that they have.
Thank you.
The second purpose advanced is that it generates revenue, and the third person purpose advanced is that it is to deter licensees from exercising their lawful right to contest the board's charges. Professionals should not be punished for having a hearing. Professionals should be punished by the authority that the board has to fine them after there's been a proven allegation of misconduct. In regards to revenue generation, the boards don't need this power. Six of the 12 boards with this power have never used it, thus generating no revenue whatsoever. The Board of Dentistry, during the five-year period from August of 2003 to the present, has issued a single regulatory costs order in the amount of $7,389.85. And the Oregon Medical Board, over the 4 years, has generated a total of $71,728.26. Spread over 4 years, this amounts to $17,000 per year, and that's an inconsequential amount because spread over all medical board licensees, this potential loss of revenue amounts to a dollar per licensee per year. But the real evil in this process, in this law, is found in the boards having the power, and is found not in its exercise, but in the fact of its existence. It has a chilling effect on all licensees and deters them from challenging the board and challenging the state of facts as the board believes them. And in the face of this potential consequence of being charged with the regulatory costs of this disciplinary proceeding, is that licensees do not contest matters when these allegations are brought that are not factually accurate. You no doubt will hear that there is no deterrent effect resulting from licensees having to pay their own lawyer because professional liability insurance, it is claimed, provides reimbursement for the professional's own attorney's fees. That contention is not well-founded, however, for several reasons. First, not all professional liability policies, even for physicians, include a provision for reimbursement of attorney's fees for board disciplinary proceedings. It's not clear that such policy is even available to professionals other than physicians, dentists, and nurses. There's an unrealistic dollar cap in the amount of the benefit in policies currently available, even when the policy contains such a benefit. And many professionals other than physicians and dentists can't afford professional liability insurance in any event.
We need to move along.
Sure.
So we wrap up on 47 and move to 46.
Yes, thank you.
I just have one question before you do.
Yes.
47, as I'm reading it, takes away the authority to assess costs even when a professional is found guilty of the misconduct that's being investigated. Is that right?
In every case where they are found guilty, Chair Greenlake, in every case where they are found guilty, the board has the authority to impose the full regulatory costs. And it doesn't matter under the law what they're found guilty of. It can be trivial.
What I'm saying is this draft of the bill we have, which is a committee bill introduced at your interest, would take away the power to assess costs even when they're found guilty. of whatever
that's,
it is.
That's absolutely correct.
Okay.
Yes, Chair Greenlee, that's absolutely
they
right.
They retain the right to fine, but not charge for fines.
That's right. They
would fine within whatever the power the board has to do with fine.
Exactly so. Exactly so, Chair Greenlee. Let me conclude with offering also this observation, which is you will also no doubt hear from some of the boards that if they lose this power, a wellspring of contested case proceedings will result and their costs will spiral out of control. These concerns are not well-founded. Board regulatory costs will not increase, and that's for several reasons. I've listed them in my testimony. I just want to mention one, which is health-related licensing boards that do not have the power to impose costs do not appear to have a significantly higher rate of hearings each year than those boards that have the power. And thus, there's no reason to expect a spike in hearings following the passage of this bill.
Are there
Thank
any other questions
much.
On 2347 before we move to 2346?
One question. What would be wrong with the prevailing party rule?
Well, certainly one of the Chair Greenlee, Representative Garrett, one improvement on this bill, which I hasten to add, I don't believe can be improved, but one improvement would be that there should be reciprocity, and so that seems to me to be and certainly an improvement would be due process. You get a bill for $43,000, I say rhetorically, that simply becomes a lien on your home, and you have no recourse.
And being the only attorney sitting up here, we have one sitting down there. By prevailing party, it means whichever party wins would pay the cost of both parties?
Correct.
Okay, let's go to 46. Still willing to say whether
service whichever party loses pays the cost. I think I misheard.
I'm sorry. Yeah.
I was just pondering it.
Well, that would be a perverse way to do it. You win, you get the pleasure of winning, but you get the
you get paid for the pleasure.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, as we turn to 46, I just might mention that the power positions of the two parties are not the same. I mean, when the board represents the government. And has the funding of 16,000 members or more, say it's the medical board, their ability to pay costs are certainly a whole lot different than an individual who may not be making much money. And so when you do have prevailing party, it doesn't necessarily make it fair because the person who wants to defend themselves may have to say, you know, if we are not successful, I lose everything. I go bankrupt. I have to sell my house to pay for this. And so it's not a fair way to get justice to say if for some reason you're found against, you're going to have to pay for all of the expenses of this. I mean, that's kind of a fundamental fairness issue, I think.
Thank you. Mr. Musel, 2346.
Thank you, Chair Greenlee. The problem here is that seven health professional regulatory boards have the authority to compel a licensee to undergo an evaluation as part of that board's investigation of a complaint or as part of an investigation begun by the board without a complaint having been filed. These boards order evaluations without any prior determination that a licensed health professional has engaged in any misconduct, has in any way practiced incompetently, or is incapable of competent and safe practice. Furthermore, the licensee who is subject to a board's evaluation order is confronted with the choice of either submitting to the ordered evaluation or being the subject of a license suspension or revocation proceeding for noncompliance with the board's evaluation order. Under current law, the board controls the selection of the evaluator. There is no board process for the licensee to object to the order and to be heard, and there is no meaningful recourse to the courts for relief from an ill-founded and oppressive evaluation order. And let me give you some examples. A physician was required to submit to an alcohol evaluation, a drug and alcohol evaluation, based on mere suspicion that the physician had an alcohol problem, which she was never permitted to contest. She had her license was suspended from the practice. She was listed on the National Data Bank of Disciplined Physicians She had two evaluations which she had to pay for that reported she had not did not have an alcohol problem. She had to pay her own legal fees and the other hearing expenses. She paid her own legal fees and the other expenses of the appeal. She prevailed on the appeal, but she paid $4,807 of the board's regulatory costs, to which the board had no legal claim. She was also reprimanded, and she paid a $3,000 fine. She was never charged with or adjudicated as having an alcohol problem. She simply didn't agree that it was okay for the board to require her to submit to their evaluation without giving her an opportunity to contest the suspicion that she had an alcohol problem. So she was punished for not complying with the board's evaluation order. She's not an alcoholic, and two evaluations provided evidence that that was the case. The second case is that as a result of a report that her performance of a procedure was not ideal. This physician was required to undergo an evaluation without any opportunity to contest the report against her or to defend her practice because she was not afforded the opportunity to challenge the report. She was compelled to submit to 3 days of unnecessary evaluation. She had to bear the multi-$1,000 cost of the unnecessary evaluation. She went to New Jersey at the direction of the board, and I've already described that to you. The defects in the current laws applicable to these agencies that are listed in my written testimony are the following. In regards to the Board of Chiropractic Examiners, there is no standard for determining when an evaluation is appropriate or justified. The Board of Chiropractic Examiners, quote, may at any time direct and order a professional competency examination limited to the area of the practice of which a specific complaint has arisen. There's no meaningful standard in regard to the Board of Dentistry, which may order an applicant or a licensee to submit to a physical exam, mental exam, or a competency exam when the board has evidence. Under this statute, the board only needs a little bit of evidence to require an evaluation. The standards for determining when an evaluation is appropriate or justified are significantly different from board to board. If you compare the evidence of the Board of Dentistry with the physical therapist standard, that provides for an objectively reasonable grounds to believe that the person is or may be unable to practice physical therapy with reasonable skill and safety. That's better, but you still don't get a basis to challenge the rationale or the facts that underlie the order. Current law provides no process for any licensee to challenge the facts or rationale that the board may have relied on in issuing its evaluation order, and there's no requirement that the facts or rationale even be set forth in the order itself. House Bill 2346 solves that, and here's how. 4346 provides a uniform objective standard which the boards must satisfy before they may issue an evaluation order. It requires the selection of impartial and professionally qualified persons to perform the evaluation, and it requires an inexpensive, limited, contested case hearing process when requested by a licensee in which the board has the burden to establish the factual basis and the rationale that supports its order. This limited hearing affords the licensee the opportunity to present evidence and the opportunity to challenge the board's evidence and rationale for the proposed evaluation. It affords fundamental due process. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Are there questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for being here. It's good to see you, Representative. It's good to see you, Frank. There's been an issue every time we've brought up this topic about the inability of the boards to deal with what they see as a safety risk, and I was wondering if you could address that.
Yes, thank you for asking, Chair Greenlick and Representative Kotek. The answer is this, which is all of these boards have the authority under the Administrative Procedures Act to immediately and without a hearing suspend the license of a healthcare professional if the board unilaterally finds and writes down and lists out, so that they thoughtfully do that, finds that the continued practice of this licensee poses a serious danger to the public health and safety. That this bill does not in any way impair that authority. And in those cases, if the board thinks that there is a lesser threat, all they have to do is to charge the threat and very promptly put on an administrative hearing with the an administrative law judge from the Office of Administrative Hearings and get that adjudicated.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Cannon?
I'm going to pass, actually.
Okay.
Closing remarks, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Just a word in that most professionals do not want to take on their board. Okay, I mean, just put yourself in that position. The last thing you want to do is contest something. When these charges are made against a professional, normally you say, whatever I've done, I am sorry for. I'm sorry for what I said. I'm sorry for what I didn't say, because you just want to get this over with. But in those rare situations where it is contested, then there needs to be due process, and so that there can be a hearing outside of those that conduct the research, conduct the investigation, and inflict the harm or the penalty, and assess the fees. That's a definition of tyranny, when all three branches of government do the same thing. That's too much power. There needs to be due process. These bills will provide that due process. Thank you.
Thank you very much, sir. I'm going to ask the witnesses, since there are a group of witnesses here for both of the bills, I'll ask for testimony on both of them simultaneously. We have only one additional person here in favor of the bills. That's let's see. That's James Brown in favor of House Bill 2347. Could I ask Mr. Brown to come forward and briefly testify? And then we'll ask several of the boards who have problems with this to come and tell us why they have problems with it.
So thank you, Chair Greenlee, members of the committee. It's always dangerous as a lawyer to give you assurance. I'll be brief, but I really think I will. I'm a practicing lawyer. I am appearing in support of House Bill 20.
Please introduce yourself.
I'm sorry. It's James M. Brown, 215 Southwest Washington Street, Portland, Oregon. I am an attorney. I am appearing in support of House Bill 2347. I've been a member of the Oregon State Bar since 1967. Brief background, I had the privilege of serving Governor Bob Straub's legal counsel in 1977-1978. I had the even greater privilege of serving as Oregon's Attorney General from March 1980 to December 1981. Since leaving state service in 1981, my private practice has emphasized issues involving state government and administrative regulation. Over the years, I've represented a number of individuals with licensing board issues. Very frankly, I had not been aware that there were a limited number of state agencies that had the power to impose costs, and further, that the Court of Appeals had held that costs meant attorney fees, because nowhere else in the statutes, in my experience, had costs meant attorney fees. And I had the occasion to represent a licensed professional counselor. One of the things I think it's easy to lose track of, Mr. Musell's clients often are physicians. Maybe it's hard to think of a physician as a small business, but most assuredly, a licensed professional counselor is a small business, just as single practitioners in other professions are. And these are folks who rent or own property, employ people, pay taxes. They're as much of the economy as whether you're selling a product or other service. If you lose your license or you spend your license, you're out of business. And so when I found in this particular instance, this professional was threatened with a loss of license, and further, that the board was asking for costs, investigative fees, costs of any kind of hearing, and their attorney fees, suddenly the stakes have gone from what my services are going to cost to what this unexpected amount is going to be, which looked like several times what my fees would be. And I found that to be very intimidating. It was not something that was a part of any kind of professional liability insurance. It would be covered in terms of either end of that. And so simply and frankly, in summary, if at the end of the day the licensee has to pay the costs of both sides, that simply is, you have to make a judgment of how much justice can you afford. And I think that is an imbalance isolated to a limited number of agencies spread overall. I don't think it is in the best interest of the state. If it is a sense of revenue for individual agencies, frankly, I think that's the legislature's responsibility to discern what kind of revenues, what kind of resources the individual licensing boards ought to have. So in my view, an agency's power to impose such costs, it's an unfair weight on the scales of justice. I appreciate your hearing me this afternoon.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. Any questions? Thank you very much for coming down. We have a group of, a gang of three that are opposed to both of them, and then some that are opposed to one. Can we have Martin Piccioni, Dennis Brott, and Dave McTeague? I'm sorry, Patrick, excuse me. We haven't seen you enough yet this year, right?
To get it right, huh?
I'm sorry. And Dave McTeague, who are opposed on both. If you could testify on both. Patrick, since I got your name wrong, why don't you start?
Okay. Well, let me start with 23. Mr. Chairman, my name is Patrick Brotz, and I'm the Executive Director of the Board of Dentistry. Let me start with 2347, which is the cost issue. And let me just explain, because, again, this bill affects a lot of boards, a lot of state agencies. But let me tell you how it works for the Board of Dentistry. We just had a board meeting this morning. Matter of fact, Dr. Huddleston, who is the president of the board, is sitting in the back. We finished our board meeting about noon today, and so that's why I was able to come here. But when a complaint is filed before the Board of Dentistry, the board reviews the complaint, and if at the conclusion of that review, which conducted an investigation, they determine that there's something wrong and there should be disciplinary action, we issue a notice of proposed disciplinary action. And in most cases, we attach to that a consent order, a way to resolve this matter. At that point, the licensee, and in most cases it's a dentist, because we don't have a lot of dental hygiene complaints, will contact their malpractice carrier. And they will be provided with an attorney to represent them to the Board of Dentistry. And actually, they would have gotten that attorney already at the investigative stage. They don't pay for that attorney. It's part of their malpractice coverage. Now, that's the majority of dentists in this state that have malpractice, and the majority of them do. They have coverage for this.
Mr. Chair, and it's adequate to cover the cost?
Yes. I've never heard an attorney get up in the middle of the thing and say, oh, the meter's done, I have to leave now. It's never been to my knowledge. So at that process, we will negotiate and try to come to a resolution, whether it be a reprimand, a suspension, a civil penalty, to revoke the license, whatever the case may be. If at the conclusion of that negotiation process, and it doesn't just happen in one day, it takes time periods, and there'll be offers thrown back and forth, the matter can't be resolved. The licensee has an opportunity to request a hearing at the very beginning of this process. We will then go ahead with that hearing. Again, their malpractice coverage will cover the attorney's fees at that hearing.
Your attorney's fees as well?
No, their attorney fees. Okay. The only cost that licensee would incur is after the hearing is done and the board is successful, would we assess costs for our assistant attorney general and the cost of the judge, the administrative hearing officer. We would never do the investigative costs, and we never have. So you say, well, this is a deterrent. Well, it is somewhat of a deterrent, because that's why in 5 years that I've been with the board, we've only had one hearing. We have one we're waiting for a decision on now. It's sort of a different issue. It's an impairment issue. And the only reason we had that hearing was because the dentist was also a lawyer. He had already admitted that he pulled the wrong tooth.
he didn't like what we had sought for the discipline. So he wanted to go to hearing because he wanted the experience as a lawyer to know what it's like to go through a contested case hearing. That experience cost him about $4,000. And he got the result. He was reprimanded, a civil penalty, as well as the cost in the matter. And I guess what I'm trying to explain to the committee is this process isn't an unfair process. There is due process through the whole time period, and the licensees know up front that this is the only thing that they're going to pay for if they decide to contest this hearing. And as Mr. Masella said, well, it's a very minor amount of money, and you can spread it, you know, over all of your licensees. That's because right now there have not been very many contested case hearings, at least for my board. Once that is done, that will no longer be there. I suspect that we'll have probably 10 to 15 hearings in a biennium, and they will range in cost anywhere from $5,000 to $7,000 for our cost, depending whether it's a one-day hearing or a two-day hearing or whatever the case may be. And so, again, I can't speak for other agencies. I can only speak for the Board of Dentistry. We don't see this change as being a positive change or a good public policy change, and I can speak most definitely recently having talked to two different groups of dentists, both in Lane County and in Clackamas County, as to whether or not they think it's appropriate that they should be paying, basically the good people, paying for all of the bad people. And there aren't very many. It's very minute. The Board of Dentistry only has so many complaints filed. There are larger numbers than we had when I started here 5 years ago. But only very many of the cases ever result in discipline. And as I said, we have, to date, only had one hearing that went to contested. And the reason was he wanted the experience. He got the experience, but it costs some money. So on that, Bill, I guess if there's questions, I'd be more than happy to answer.
Your testimony is, I want to make sure I understand it, that you do not assess charges if the dentist prevails.
Right. Because the Board of Dentistry will not take a case to hearing that it does not expect to win.
Yeah. Of course, it's true. But when your expectation is wrong, are you saying it's a matter of your administrative rule?
It's a matter of the board. No. We would not seek, it's not a rule, but the board would not seek if it was not successful in a hearing. But as I said, in the cases that would ever get to hearing, there would have to be an admission of guilt before we would take it to hearing. And at that point, that's been decided. What needs to be decided is what's going to be, whether it's a reprimand or whether it's going to be a civil penalty or revocation, whatever. That's what's going to end up getting decided at the hearing.
You're confusing me. If somebody doesn't admit guilt, then you don't take it to hearing?
Well, if someone doesn't admit guilt, unless we could prove beyond very seriously, I mean, we just haven't. There just haven't been no cases, and I've gone back prior to my predecessors, where we would take a case to hearing that we felt was a risky case. We just don't do it. It's just, you know, administrative law is different than criminal and civil law, so it's pretty well laid out that the standard of care wasn't there. The person fell below the standard of care. It can be proven very easily by bringing in another dentist. What would a reasonable dentist in Oregon do? The reasonable dentist says, I wouldn't treat the patient this way. Then that's the standard of care. Now, again, I can't speak for all the other boards. I can only speak for what the Board of Dentistry
does. But you're saying you never take a case to contested hearing if the dentist hasn't admitted guilt. Is that what I've heard
you say? This board, as it's constituted today, would never take a case, and I would not recommend them to do so, if the preponderance was not that they were going to be successful in the hearing.
That wasn't my question. Because I thought I heard you say you never take it to... You only take people to hearings if they've already admitted guilt.
That's true. That's the only case we've had to date that we've successfully went through a hearing. There have been no other cases that have gone to hearing. They've all been settled prior to that time with an admission of finding something wrong. They just don't take the cases to hearing. They don't see it as being a necessary...
So all I have to do to avoid a hearing or a finding is to say I don't admit to any guilt, and then it goes away? Is that what you're saying?
No, it doesn't go away. I'm saying that the facts of the case that are presented at the time of the allegations are such that they can't be refuted in a hearing. What we're going to hearing on is the decision of what is the discipline going to be, not whether or not the licensee committed an act. We know he committed the act. He or she has already admitted to that. It's whether or not they think the discipline is appropriate. In our case, now I can't speak for the other boards.
I guess it's taking up time, but I'm going to try again. Because I keep asking you one question, you keep giving me a different answer, and I'm easily confused at this time of the day. You said you only take cases to hearings if the dentist has admitted guilt.
I said in the only case we've ever taken to hearing, that is the only case. In the 5 years that I've been with the board, and there have been very few.
So you wouldn't mind a bill that said you can't take any case to hearing unless somebody admits guilt? Is that what you're saying?
I don't think so, because it depends on what the case would be.
I don't think so.
But I'm just saying that in the circumstances involved, it's not like, you know, where you think you've got enough on the person because he's got the gun in his hand and there's blood on the floor.
You got it.
It's not how we do it.
I'm confused.
Yeah, I'm confused, too. Maybe you can straighten it out.
Maybe not. So are you.
Yeah, that's true. I didn't
have any
luck.
The two of us were in real trouble. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We're just a paradox, or a trio with the three of us.
Okay. I think that the one case that you cited is the one that is in the testimony provided by Mr. Musselman. Thank you. And this is the one case where guilt was admitted, and the individual also, for the experience, questioned the severity of the process or of the fine, et cetera, right?
Correct.
So it's the questioning, the admission of guilt and the questioning of the appropriateness of the penalty or the fine that resulted in doing this. Correct?
Correct.
Okay. There, in other cases, there was admission of guilt, acceptance of the penalty as handed down.
Correct.
No hearing. You feel, though, if I understood you correctly, that you would have 10 to 15 challenges per year, would have had in your five-year period 50 to 75 such challenges in the absence of the change that would be made by this bill. Is that correct?
Chair Greenlick, Vice Chair Harker, yes, I believe that is correct. Because of the individual, again, there would have been an admission or very clearly there were some mistakes made. It's simply the resolution. What is going to be the discipline? And if the opportunity is that I can take this to a full hearing and it's not going to cost me any additional money, why not take it to the full hearing?
Mr. Kettimer, maybe you can...
Well, the third PhD can surely get it
That's
right.
It. Huh? Well, we have at least four here, so.
Yeah, well, maybe the fourth will get it. I guess another way of saying this is that is it fair to say that it's very likely that the potential cost of losing at a hearing encourages people to admit guilt and resolve it rather than... And your other point is that obviously, if it doesn't cost anything to contest whatever the disciplinary action is, why wouldn't you take the shot?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Kenmer, I think the issue is that in reviewing the case, we have cited a number of violations that are very clear in the record. And so there isn't anything that's going to be argued at the hearing about the violations. It's, again, what is the resulting discipline for those violations.
Mr. Chair, if I could, one more thing, I guess. I guess part of it, too, is your board may be a little different from some in that your standards are a little bit more objective, and if you can sort of tell pretty clearly whether the wrong tooth was pulled, as it was your example.
Chair Green, Representative Kimmer, yes, that's correct. And that's why I'm saying I can't speak for all the boards. I can only speak for us and the circumstances that would happen regarding our board.
Do you have anything on 46?
Yes, on 2346. Again, I can only go with the...
I'm sorry, Mr. Garrett, Representative Garrett, do you want to...
I'll pass for now.
Again, I can only go, again, to the circumstances that we use for our board. We do have the power to order these competency hearings. We've had a number of cases in the 5 years that I've been there where we have gotten allegations from individuals that there's been something wrong with a particular dentist, whatever that may be. In all of those cases, we have done an investigation, called the individual in, and sat down with what evidence we had at that point to say, you know, we're not sure that there's something wrong with you mentally, physically, or your competency. We'd like you to go and get an evaluation. If you refuse, the board can order that evaluation. In all the instances, and thinking today and talking with staff, I think there have been five or six, no one has refused to have the evaluation done, so we've never issued the order. You can say, well, the reason that's the case is because they knew you were going to issue order if you didn't, and it may be correct. But the only way, the reason we need this power and this ability is that we're at the very beginning part of the stage. We're not at the end of the stage. We're looking at these allegations at this time, and if there's something dealing with mental or physical issues, we are not experts in that area. We need to get people in that are experts and have the individual evaluated. Now, if we were to use our power and actually order that hearing, it would be a very public matter because of any order issued by the board is public. And at that point, and contrary to what Mr. Michel said, there is a due process and a recourse. They can take us to the court system and ask to overturn the board's decision. Not a contested case hearing, but an actual trial before a judge where the board would have to put on evidence and so would the other side. The reason we're opposed to having a contested case hearing at this process is, as I said earlier, the contested case hearing comes at the end of the process when all the evidence has been vetted, when all the information has come forward. At this point, we're still trying to get investigative information, which is what these hearings are or what the competency exams are. They are a tool. They're an evidence tool. And again, in our cases, we've not had to issue the order. I know in the medical board's cases, there have been some cases where they've had to issue the order. But again, they've come forward. They've been willing to do this. They know we have the power to issue it. In at least one of the circumstances, after completing the examination, it was determined that there wasn't anything wrong. And so there was no public information about this because it was done as part of our investigative process. So there is no public information until the board issues a notice. And so, you know, there was no embarrassment, if you want to say the case, and it worked very well. Again, this doesn't happen very often. We don't get these kind of cases very often. In 5 years, as I said, there have been five or six instances where we've had reports from either fellow employees, family, that something's wrong. Something's just not right with the doctor today, and we need some help. We think it's affecting the practice. How can you help us?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Martin Pitioni, and I'm the executive director for the Board of Clinical Social Workers. And today I have the privilege to appear before you in opposition to House Bill 2347. Mr. Chair, since you're taking the tandem approach, I do want to point out I do have my board vice chair, Becky Rasmussen, here in the audience, who would like to speak on House Bill 2346, which we're also opposed to. I'll just take 2347 briefly, and I just kind of want to give the committee a little bit of data that's specific to this board, because the boards are diverse, and not every board works exactly the same way as the other board, and I think it's important to have a little bit of appreciation for the diversity. My board has a licensee base of 3,500 licensees. We have a complaint load of about 50 cases a year. And in calendar year 2008, where we were very busy, we issued a total of 9 final orders. All of those orders, no exceptions, were settlements, negotiated resolutions with licensees and their counsel during the complaint process that produced a final order outcome quickly with discipline in the public domain and without the need to enter a contested case process that is lengthy and expensive. The board is strongly committed to public protection, and we are fully aware that a key element in our success is to resolve these cases quickly. I will be the first to admit that the board's ability to put the issue of assessing costs on the table should a licensee contest and lose at the administrative hearing level is a key ingredient in motivating the licensees to enter negotiations with the board. Now, I do want to be very clear about what the story is here. The issue is not that the board is wildly out of control and wildly assessing costs. I looked at the record of the board of the last 5 years. I found 2 cases in which a cost was assessed. Both of those cases were part of stipulated resolutions. In one case, 2008, $500 were assessed, and in 2005, costs of $1,377 were assessed. As such, you know, as far as I can tell from the record of this board, the licensees are certainly not overrun with costs, nor can a case of the board abusing that power be made, nor are we swimming in a sea of revenue from this. The basic simple truth is that the primary effect for this board for having that cost recovery authority is to have a little bit of a motivation for the licensees to actually negotiate with the board. The contested case curing costs are expensive. If we do need to take a case of hearing, we are looking basically at a minimum of $10,000 per case at the very minimum, and that really assumes a not complex case, you know, no more than 1 or 2 days at hearing, not a lot of witnesses, no costs at the Court of Appeals stage, none of those things. So the basic reality is that at the end of the day, the board's ability to say, look, you know, yes, you can take us to hearing on this, but, you know, I also want you to understand that at the end of the day, if you lose, you know, we do have that ability. It does help us at least get them to the table to negotiate. What we're concerned about, if 2347 were to become law, is that we would have a much higher frequency of cases going to a contested case process. Now, again, if I go back to the board's record of 2008, if I had to take 9 cases to that contested case process, then, quite frankly, issue number one is the resolution of that case would take 6 to 8 months longer. Now, with all due respect to Mr. Mosell, I would like to know what kind of a hotline he may have to the Office of Administrative Hearings, because there is no quick way to get a hearing at the Office of Administrative Hearings. You are talking a reality of a minimum of 4 to 6 months to get that case resolved. So, going back to the financial end, so first of all, on the public protection end, it means you delay the resolution that much longer. On the financial end, it means for those 9 cases alone, I would have to come up with a minimum, and that's the extreme minimum conservative number, $90,000 just to fund those expenses, again, on a very conservative basis. Now, if you look at the physical size of the budget of the board, and you set that against our current biennium legislatively approved budget level of about $660,000, then I think the committee begins to appreciate kind of the level of issue that represents for the board. The picture that was painted to you earlier that somehow these boards have, you know, these huge money banks, and it's really not a problem for us to take a case through the contested case hearings process from a financial level is, quite frankly, at least for my board, I don't know where that's coming from. Basically, for us, what it means is if this bill were to become law, we have to be worried about having the funds for taking a lot more cases through the contested case process. You know, and for us, that means that's the only place we can pass on those costs is fees. And, you know, quite frankly, for us, we don't want to go there. Social workers who we regulate, they serve a vulnerable clientele. They do not make much money. Keeping licensure costs reasonable and accessible is very important to us. And, you know, quite frankly, the professional association, the Oregon chapter of National Association of Social Workers, they have been extremely kind and supportive of the board's initiative last year to raise fees to address the rising cost of complaints before the board. They agree that we should be able to raise fees in order to fund, you know, the first professional staff position for an actual, you know, investigator compliance specialist on staff. That was huge. We're now in the final stages in Ways and Means to get that finalized. We want to keep those fees reasonable. We don't want to have to go back again and say to them, oh, sorry, we're now also going to have another $90,000 or $130,000 possibly a year in costs to fund that then basically end up meaning that the good licensees end up funding the few bad apples in the profession. One final comment I'd like to make. I had the pleasure of serving for a number of years as the executive director for another board, the Board of Psychologist Examiners, a few years ago. I can't speak for that board now. I do want to draw on that experience a little bit. That board did not have cost recovery authority. And, you know, I can tell you from my experience then, it was far harder to get to case settlement. I also understand that that board now faces very significant challenges in terms of numbers of contested cases, related financial difficulties, and the need for major fee increases. And that's an issue that's very prevalent right there, right now.
You know, because it's psychologists are more contentious than social workers.
Chair Green.
No, you don't have to come in.
I would really disagree with that, with all due respect.
I have taken up enough of the committee's time. I simply respectfully request that you carefully consider the board's opposition. And if you go further with this bill, please do look very carefully at the operational and the cost impact and the implications for the profession. We believe that our current process is not broken. I'm happy to have anybody on the committee take a look at the public record of our disciplinary orders. And for the record, just to point out one difference with the Board of Dentistry, you know, for us the issue is not if we were to take a case to hearing whether there is an admission of guilt or not. That's a, you know, quite frankly, most of our cases are really very straightforward. You know, you're talking about somebody who committed billing fraud, quite a few sexual misconduct cases. I mean, you either slept with a client or you didn't sleep with a client. I mean, we're talking about relatively straightforward stuff, and quite frankly, for us, the ability to get especially the sexual predators out and then dealt with quickly is a huge issue when you're dealing with a very vulnerable population in mental health services delivery, and that's another reason why we're really concerned about this. And thank you for your time.
Did I also hear you say that you don't assess charges if... You only assess charges if your licensee loses a case.
I believe so, and quite frankly, we've never even had to go there. So,
thank you. Any questions?
Yes. Thank you, yes. Mr. Chair. Sorry, I just have to ask. So, in a case of social worker sleeping with a client, would you just immediately suspend that license, or would you wait for negotiation? I'm just wondering. In that's a pretty egregious situation. So I mean, that might get to the weak. That's a public safety issue. I think you would have the ability to suspend that person right then and there. Is that what happens?
Chair Kling, the representative Kotek, no. The issues is when we get this stuff, we still have to do an investigation and make sure that the allegations are actually true before we can go out and before we would go out and issue an order. I mean, quite frankly, the legal threshold you have to meet to get to an emergency suspension order is extremely high. It's extremely high. I mean, if you think about it, if you're talking about a profession where you've been, you know, in school for, you know, basically 20-some years, you're going through supervised practice, and you're basically having your entire livelihood on the line, being able to take somebody's license away basically on zero notice, saying you can't be in this profession, you know, the next day, that's a huge issue. And we have a huge evidentiary standard to meet. And no, it's not enough for us to get a phone call or a letter saying this person slept with me. You know, we do have to follow up and make sure that there's actually some truth behind these allegations, because otherwise it would be, quite frankly, rather simple for someone to, you know, inflict, quite frankly, an incredible amount of... We have to balance both sides, and that's part of the difficulty. And it is true what Representative Richardson said. It is a unique system in administrative law, because you are, you know, judge and jury, and you are all under one roof, and we are incredibly aware of the responsibility that comes with that. And so we can't just say, just because there's an allegation, we have to assume that it's true. We have to follow up. We have to do an investigation. Now, obviously, if we get a sexual misconduct case, it will ratchet right to the very top of the priority list to make sure that we get that done, and we get that done as quickly as we can. But no, we have had a number of revocations, the ultimate penalty for that, because obviously you don't want these people in the profession. But we have not yet done that via the emergency suspension route.
Follow up?
No, we're going to move on.
Okay.
Thank you, I'm the boss right now.
All right, Mr. Vice Chair.
No, did you?
No, I can wait.
Okay. Mr. McTeague.
For the good of the order.
Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee, Dave McTeague, Executive Director, Chiropractic Board of Examiners. I'll start with the cost recovery bill 2347. I passed out some testimony, and the case that Mr. Musel referred to, we seldom actually assess costs in our disciplinary actions, and only in recent years in extraordinary cases. This was one of those extremely extraordinary cases. It was a long-running investigation, must have lasted 2.5+ years. Very difficult process. We went to contested case hearing, 5 days of contested case hearing. Hearings officer found in favor of the board's proposed revocation, and it seemed reasonable in this case, considering the extensive history of this case, that cost recovery was appropriate, and it was, and the cost recovery was all those highly documentable items such as attorney general legal costs, expert witness costs. I had bills and receipts for all the things that the board decided to request cost recovery on. The idea that there wasn't appeal, the licensee did not avail himself of the opportunity to appeal the board's final order to the Oregon Court of Appeals. So there was that process that did not occur. That's all I've got to say on that subject. On the other bill, the competency evaluation bill, we've had this authority in our statute for quite some time. It's another one of those seldom used but potentially important authorities that the board has. You know, in recent years, we've seen that if we need to ask a licensee to go out for an evaluation, oftentimes we just suggest it and it gets done. And that's a nice way for it to get done. We had a case recently where I had an order ready to go, but it was a doc who had a series of strokes, and he needed to have an evaluation. We needed to know if he was able to competently practice chiropractic. Well, we just poured a little honey in on the problem and talked to him and told him we respected him and we really needed to have this done. And so by working with him gently, we got him into the evaluation and got the results back, that the information that the board needed. You know, had he been contentious and didn't want to submit to the, then we would have had to issue the order. The board needed the information. Turns out, you know, he can still practice, and we have him work. We have a mentor that's checking up with him, and everything's cool, and he's happy that we treated him with the respect he deserved. So it's one of those authorities that potentially is very important. We don't think we've ever overreached or abused this authority. But I would stress it's part of the investigative process. We're trying to get information for the board so they can make an informed decision. And sometimes that this is information that the board might need. We also have a situation where we have 330 licensed inactive doctors, and the board has a policy that if a chiropractor is completely out of practice for 5 years, that they need to take a national competency examination, which is a 200-question multiple-choice exam devised for this purpose by the National Board of Chiropractic Examiners. And in one case a few years ago, we did issue a competency evaluation order to have that done, and the doctors took the exam, and they passed, and now they have an active license. Under the language of House Bill 2346, we would have to make a showing that there is an objectively reasonable basis to believe the licensee poses a danger to the patient health or safety. The burden on the OBC would be to allege a chiropractor is a danger, which may not be the case at all, rather than on the chiropractor to demonstrate minimal competency after being completely out of practice for an extended period of time. So I see, you know, a potential issue with that language.
Yes. Attorney Cote?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes. Mr. Mateek, could you point out where it would not allow, because my reading of this, and I read it very quickly, but you're not allowed to require if there is involved in a complaint issue, but what you're talking about is a scope of practice continuing education issue, which I would consider separate when you're talking about a renewal. So could you point out why that would be the case.
You mean the case with the inactive doctor going
Correct.
Active who's
Correct.
Been out of practice?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we would need them to take an evaluation. My reading of the bill is that they would likely be covered.
Well, but in Section 2 it says you cannot do that if it is part of an investigation by the board of a complaint against the licensee. I guess unless there's another section I'm not seeing.
Well, really it's not a complaint. It's a doctor who's trying to change his license status from inactive to active.
Correct.
And he's been out of practice for an extended period of time, like over 5 years. And
Correct.
We're not sure he's, you know, we just, at that point, at the five-year mark, we get to get a little concerned that are you still competent to practice if you haven't done anything for 5 years? And you know you want to go back into active practice.
Mr. Chair, I understand that. I guess what I'm not sure is if it indeed would not allow you to do that kind of evaluation, I think we want to make sure. I'm not reading it that way.
Okay.
I'm not reading that it would not, you would not still be permitted to do that. But if we could just get I just wanted to.
No, it isn't the basic qualifications to practice. It's an allegation of a complaint.
Okay.
No,
okay.
I think you're reading it correctly.
Okay.
Well, I'll look at it again. I looked at it and I read that we have issued an order for competency evaluation, reference those specific statutes that this bill affects in that one case, and that would that's what made me think it would be affected.
Okay. Well, we should check on
because you're amending those statutes in our law that says that.
Okay. Thank you very much. We have one more panel. I ask them to be brief. We have one more bill. Let me say that we have announced the first public hearing on 2243. When we get to that next, we'll just take one witness because we're waiting for some amendments on that, and we'll hear that probably the end of next week, but there is a witness in town that cannot make it back, so we will, as soon as we're done, hear from Dr. Gilson. But we have one more panel here. Let's see. Who do we have? We have Becky Rasmussen, that we heard, the chair of the board. We have Holly Mercer again. It's always our pleasure to have Holly with us. And Lori Mackman, is that? Mackman? And we actually have a little testimony on both bills. But two of you are just on 46, I think. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Any order?
Go ahead. Okay. Chair Greenwick and members of the committee, my name is Becky Rasmussen, and I'm a licensed clinical social work in private practice in Salem. And I currently serve as vice chair of the Board of Clinical Social Workers, and I've been actively involved in the board's impairment program. Today, I appear before you on behalf of the board in opposition to House Bill 2346, and thank you for allowing me to testify. The board has a licensee base of 3,500 licensees, and licenses on a voluntary title protection basis, clinical social work associates, or CSWAs, and licensed clinical social workers, LCSW. Our licensees can be found in a variety of settings, such as hospitals, schools, medical clinics, mental health clinics, and in private practice, as well as community settings in both urban and rural areas. I want to differentiate. On our board, we have two committees that may be relevant here. The board operates both a consumer protection committee, and that reviews complaints and investigates all complaints. Those complaints are more of the competency at a skill level. And then we have an impairment committee. And what that does, the latter investigates and monitors any cases in which there are allegations that a licensee has a mental health, drug, or alcohol impairment that could mean the licensee is unsafe to practice. So we have two different committees that handles that. And at any given time, the board's impairment program has about 5 to 8 active cases. The board's impairment committee has, in at least 5 years, never had a licensee turn down a request for an evaluation. If a licensee were to disagree with our request, A speedy resolution is of the essence in order to protect the public from a potentially impaired licensee. If this bill passes, its proposed resolution of inserting a contested case process into the middle of an investigatory process means that a resolution is unacceptably far off and much slower and more expensive than the current option of a challenge in circuit court. It would take 4 to 6 months minimum just to make it through the contested case process required by this bill, and then another 1 to 2 months for the evaluations to be performed. So if you put yourselves in the shoe of the board with a primary mission of public protection and you have a serious allegation of a drug or alcohol or mental health impairment of a licensee, that could seriously impact the ability of the licensee to practice. You want that data as to what's going on with the licensee quickly and act on it quickly. If the data is 6 to 8 months away, it would likely force the board to take action in the absence of data, including an emergency suspension with an immediate loss of ability to practice. This, in our view, is not a good net public policy result, not for public protection, not for the board, and not for the licensee. I also want to point out some previous testimony, too, of some evaluations. They were referred to places long ways away. I think New Jersey was mentioned. We are very sensitive to be geographically sensitive to refer them to at least 3 evaluators, too, that are in the area where they practice and live. So our current system is not broken. The board respectfully requests your consideration that this bill would make the board's difficult and critical job of public protection much more difficult. And thank you for considering our view, and let me know if I can answer any questions.
Thank you for coming. Let's finish the panel. Who's next?
Good afternoon, Chairman Greenlick and members. I'm Lori Makinen, Director of the Veterinary Board, and I'm here to present the board's opposition to House Bill 2346. I'd like to tell you why we feel this bill would hurt our ability to protect the public. Last September, we learned that a client took his family's puppy to a doctor whom I'll call Dr. X for a wellness exam. This doctor's hands were shaking, and he handled the puppy so roughly that she nipped him, whereupon he choked her and shook her until she urinated. The client reported this to us, and given Dr. X's history of this type of complaint, as well as some other compliance issues that we've had with him, the board decided that he needed an evaluation, and we directed him to have one within 7 days with a psychiatrist who specializes in evaluating medical professionals. She advised that Dr. X is not fit to practice veterinary medicine, and so the board issued an emergency suspension order. That was in September. The hearing for this emergency suspension order is scheduled for this March. If the provisions of this bill applied when we received this complaint, we would probably still be waiting for a hearing to determine whether or not a judge even thinks an evaluation is necessary. This bill creates a loophole that allows an incompetent or impaired practitioner to continue practicing and potentially harming patients for at least 21 days before even requesting a contested case hearing. Given the due process already in place, the practitioner can delay and postpone the hearing for months. And I have examples of how that works if you'd like to hear them. We're waiting 6 months for a hearing, as I said, on this emergency suspension. The proponents of this bill will claim that expanding Dr. X's due process rights beyond the reasonable and adequate ones he already has is more important than immediately stopping him from hurting pets. They will claim that the board can still issue an emergency suspension without an evaluation, but that is not true. We can't issue an emergency suspension without compelling evidence. You have to show through an emergency suspension that there is imminent harm of public safety. And without an evaluation result, we have nothing more to base an emergency suspension on than a client's report. Waiting months to obtain the evidence is no way to protect those of us who rely on veterinarians for our pets' safety and care. HB 2346 not only takes away an essential regulatory tool, but it also may erode the licensee's privacy. Currently, when the board issues an order for evaluation, the licensee is protected by state confidentiality law. If the evaluation finds the licensee competent, that's the end of it. The interim order is not public. Under HB 2346, if the evaluation notice can be contested, then it is a public document, even if the subsequent evaluation finds the licensee competent. I think if you asked any licensee to sacrifice their privacy for another hearing opportunity, they'd choose not to have unproven suspicion of incompetence become part of their permanent public record. And in fact, the Oregon Veterinary Medical Board, I believe, is here also to support our opposition to this bill. You've heard today and probably will continue to hear concerns about boards overreaching their authority. The proponents of HB 2346 would have us believe that boards have unrestrained power and abuse it. Last session, with Senate Bill 134, we requested this authority to issue evaluation orders. On May 1st, 2007, testifying against our bill, a representative of the Oregon State Bar urged an amendment that would have inserted provisions identical to those of HB 2346. This witness said that the board already had a huge amount of authority and didn't need additional power to order an expensive, invasive, career-damaging evaluation. As to damaging careers, I again remind you that both the 07 amendment to Senate Bill 134 and this bill exposed the licensee to public disclosure of the board's suspicion of incompetence before the licensee has had a chance to disprove them. 2 years ago, Senator Avakian's committee rejected provisions similar to HB 2346. Since we've gained authority to obtain an evaluation, we've only used it twice. In the first instance, further action was unnecessary because the licensee was convicted in criminal court of multiple counts of child sexual abuse and incest. The other case against Dr. X is, again, waiting for a hearing. But thanks to our authority to use the interim order to evaluate, Dr. X doesn't have an opportunity to harm people's pets unless and until a judge rules otherwise. I hope these examples demonstrate for you that this board does not use its authority capriciously or improperly. HB 2346 adds unnecessary protection for the licensee at the expense of protecting the public. In view of the time and effort this committee has spent on ensuring that boards actually do protect the public, we hope you will agree that HB 2346 is counterproductive to that effort, and we respectfully urge you to reject it. I'm happy to answer any questions you have.
Thank you. Mercer?
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, my name is Holly Mercer. I'm the executive director of the Board of Nursing. Given the length of this testimony, I will reduce my testimony to some facts. As I stated in before this board last Wednesday,
we're very reluctant to accept facts.
I know. They're pretty interesting, though. Our board is probably the largest healthcare professional board with oversight of over 70,000 licenses. Given the fact that we have 70,000 licenses, we also have more complaints. We look at 2,100 complaints a year. But I have to say that when I did the research to find out how many times we actually order the types of evaluations that are mentioned in 2346, we don't actually keep statistics on that, so we did an informal survey of our investigators. And if we include chemical dependency orders and mental competency orders, in the last year, we did approximately 8. Of those, 2 were mental competency orders. And given the number of complaints that we look at on an annual basis of 2,100, I think that the numbers would show that we are very judicious about having these orders. A piece of, I think, this message that has been mentioned, but I don't want it to be lost, is how this benefits licensees. Licensees are, in our world, in the world of nursing, are very anxious to cooperate with the board and to tell their part of the story. And in most instances, they want to have the evaluation, to have the chance to even be exonerated. And I think that what we want to do is to continue to provide that opportunity to a licensee and have that be a private matter. I also, Chair Greenlick, need to clarify some language that is specific to the Board of Nursing, and if I could direct the committee to the specific section on page 4 of the bill at lines 37 through 43. This is the language that was given the authority to the Board of Nursing to conduct physical condition, mental health, and chemical dependency evaluations. This was given to us in 1999 as a result of a very worrisome kind of mental condition case. If you then turn over to page 2 of the bill and you look at lines 8 through 10, we need some clarification because subsection 5 states that sections 1 through 4 of the bill do not apply to sub B any examination being required by a health professional regulatory board to determine illegal drug use by a licensee or applicant. What we would propose, if this bill happens to go forward, we definitely need clarification because chemical dependency is a broader term than illegal drug use. Mm-hmm. And chemical dependency would include, and we have many of these situations at the Board of Nursing, alcohol dependency and abuse, prescription drug dependency and abuse, and in a few recent cases, medical marijuana cases, that we need to have evaluations. The purpose of this is to provide an investigatory tool for the board. And as many complaints as we have found that in some instances, and many instances, in fact, it's just as helpful for the licensee as it is for the board. And without that, we are going forward with incomplete investigations. And particularly, we need to clear up the chemical dependency portion of this bill because if we are going to go to contested case on every single chemical dependency evaluation, I venture to say that in years to come, I seriously doubt that the Board of Nursing would be able to withstand the cost of our Department of Justice bills. As it is, in 2008, we had 23 contested case requests, 9 went to hearing, 14 settled. Our DOJ bill runs about $30,000 a month. And we do not have cost recovery in our board, so we pay the freight for those contested case hearings. And it's about $11,000 to $15,000 for each of those. And with all due respect to Mr. Musel, I do not know that I know of a limited, inexpensive contested case. And if we add another layer of contested case to these proceedings, not only will it delay these proceedings beyond our 6 to 8 months now that we're looking at in contested case, but it will also incredibly slow down, I think, a fairly expeditious proceeding that we have now. And that process is to allow these evaluations, get the information to the board, and let the board make the decision. I welcome any questions.
Holly, I think we're at a place where we need to stop right now. We'll take under advisement where we're going with this, and before we move further on it, if we decide to go that direction, I think I'll try and bring some of the board folks together with some, perhaps a couple of members of the committee, to see if there's some way we can move to protect the due process rights without screwing up the process, and see if there's somewhere we can move that will help this, because I think your comment was right. We've been working hard to make sure the public is protected, but on the other hand, we want to make sure the rights of professionals are protected, and I think we do recognize that these are very threatening things to some members of the board, I mean to some members of the profession, and I think we need to find a way to see if we can reasonably deal with that as well. But I think at the moment I'll close these hearings on these two bills. We'll take it under advisement, and we'll let you know if and how we're going to move forward on these bills. Thank everybody who's come and testified on this. We very much appreciate this testimony. And we'll close the hearing on House Bill 2346 and House Bill 2347. And we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2243. And we'll call Dr. Gilson to testify because he's not going to be able to come back when we're going to more fully handle this bill. But as he comes up, Madam Administrator, would you just give us a brief...
I will, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2243 does two things. It changes the name of the Board of Examiners of Nursing Home Administrators to the Nursing Home Administrators Board. It also is incorporating or establishes within the Health Licensing Agency the Nursing Home Administrators Board. It transfers them from an independent board status into the Health Licensing Agency. And it has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much. Please introduce yourself.
Chairman Greenlick, members of the committee, I'm Ron Gelson. I'm a physician from Eugene, Oregon. I've been licensed actually in Oregon since 1973. I'm a geriatrician, family practitioner. I am medical director in four nursing homes, which is why I think I was appointed to the as a physician member of the Board of Nursing Home Administrators. I've been on the board for about 5 years, and we've really investigated this issue, and it's unanimous decision on all the board members that we would like to proceed transferring the regulatory authority to the Oregon Health Licensing Agency. We would like to change our name. There really is not any controversy, at least among the board members. We think it would help for financial reasons and for regulatory reasons.
Well, Dr. Gilson, thank you. My understanding is there is no opposition to this. Both the governor's staff and the agency and your board all think it would be a useful thing to do. We'll post it for a work session. Turned out there needed to be a technical amendment. Something got written incorrectly on the bill, but my assumption is that we don't hear from anybody who opposes it. We'll hear it perhaps next Friday, a week from today, and we'll probably move it at that time.
Okay. Great.
Thank you very much for coming.
Are there any questions?
Yes.
My only comment is the issue of consistency in with our other boards and board length. I noticed that this would extend the length of the term from 3 to 4 years on the board. I know that was an issue for some boards.
We haven't decided that yet.
We haven't decided.
The general things we determine when we do those boards will come over into this board. They'll be worked out by Ledge Council at the end. So I think all we intended to do in this time is to move the existing board from one place to another place.
Correct.
And they weren't intending to make any other changes in the operation of the board. So any of those things like term and all those other things will come up in our other bills. Okay. I think that's right, Sandy, and that's what I've been told. There's also some interest in doing it quickly because I think they've already done it. Yes, Representative Cote.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Very briefly, just because the nursing home administrator's topic is here, given our previous conversation, would it be possible to get a record of how often folks that you oversee are disciplined? Someone asked me, you know, when there's an issue at a nursing home and they go after the line staff, are the administrators ever disciplined, you know, being outside of professional conduct? And I didn't know the answer to that question.
Yes, so they are. Mm-hmm. And I'd have to refer to the record. But I know over the past 5 years, it's infrequent, but we do. We get complaints and we interview, you know, and we look at the complaints for the due process again, you know, because, you know, you can be criticized by staff who are unhappy with how the nursing homes run. You understand the situation. Mm-hmm. And so, but it's not very frequent.
Okay. This is one of those interesting things where DHS regulates the nursing home. But the board regulates nursing home administrators, and how that works is an interesting matter.
Well, and because I got in a conversation with someone that if one could argue that if there is inappropriate activity happening at the line level, the staff level, and the manager is technically in charge, therefore, if the manager gets off scot-free, is there something wrong? I mean, you can find the nursing home and find the line staff, but I was just wondering where the administrators fall on this, because ultimately, one could argue they're in charge and responsible.
Certainly hope so.
It's captain of the ship is what you're thinking of, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Of course, if it's a licensed nurse, they have their own board, you know, just like I have mine. And if you're licensed, then. But still, we do bring those situations to the attention of the administrator and reemphasize that they are the captain of the ship.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks for coming. Close the public hearing on 2243. Carry that over. We'll have a public hearing and a work session on this probably a week from today. I'll open the public hearing on 2241. Madam Administrator, what have we got in front of us here?
Mr. Chair, what we have, House Bill 2241 comes to us at the request of the Board of Chiropractic Examiners via through the Governor's Office. What this is doing is it increases the per diem, statutory per diem of $30 a day for board and commission members to the current United States Internal Revenue Service per diem rate, which is $109 a day. And it does exclude the medical board and the Board of Nursing because they set their own per diem rates.
You back?
Yeah.
Come on.
excuse me, but all other health boards?
We have to deal with this. The statutes talk about a minimum of $30 a day. Mm-hmm. There is wide variation among the health boards on what they do, both in terms of a sort of expense and in terms of a sort of compensation. And they vary from $30 a day to $300 a day, I think, in terms of the, I think that number's right. And they vary in terms of they pay actual expense or they don't pay actual expense. Or it's we were hoping to get some standard in it, but... I'm not sure this will get us there, but it's a start. You want to try it?
Well, give it a shot. Dave McTeague, Board of Chiropractic Examiners. This bill was developed with conversations among the boards and with the governor's office in the interim, and this is the suggestion that the governor's office came up with, and in the end, for some reason, they said maybe we could introduce this as a Board of Chiropractic bill, and I said, well, sure, why not? You know, we need a vehicle to have this discussion. We also see that you've addressed this with very flexible language in House Bill 2058, which has its advantages as well. I think most of the health boards, with the exception of nursing and medical, and I'll stand corrected if I'm wrong, get the $30 a day per diem, and it's been that way forever and ever. They do also receive, you know, mileage expenses as well for those that drive, and the $30 a day really is hardly any kind of compensation for the amount of effort and cost to the professional members and the public members as well for service on these boards. You heard from the nursing board executive the other day about the tremendous workload of her board members. Our board members, chiropractic board, also put in many, many, many hours a month and commitment and a significant cost to their professional lives while they serve on the board, and I'm sure it's that way with many of the other boards. Basically, the bottom line, I think, is that it, for a lot of reasons, it would be nice to give us the flexibility to update these per diems to a more reasonable level, whether if you want to do it with the 2058 language that leaves it entirely up to the boards to make that call, or if you want to set a ceiling as to what would be a reasonable amount, that would be a policy decision for you to make. We, the Board of Chiropractic, does have a policy package going along with our budget to increase it to $109. That's what the governor's office approved for us to request through the budget process, and that's contingent upon adoption of either of these bills.
I think there is more variation than that. You could nod. The dental board's different than this, too, isn't it? It's the same? Yeah, and the 2058, I think, says a minimum of 30.
Right.
And actual expenses. I think we put that up to actual. Okay. We do need to figure out what to do with this. It's wrong now. I think board members are not adequately compensated. We'll take this under advisement and see how it fits into what we do. We can assure you we will do something about it.
Thank you.
Make sure you you probably ought to have more flexibility. Doesn't seem this is something that ought to be done in statute. Any other questions, Mr. McTeague? Hey, thank you for your testimony in both cases. We'll close a public hearing on 2241, and we'll have some announcements.
Not necessarily announcements, Mr. Chair, but what we do have is we've been passing out some paper, even though we are striving for paperless, but people submit written testimony, and I want to acknowledge that you have on House Bill 2346 for the record, written testimony in opposition from Felicia Holgate, the Occupational Therapy Licensing Board. You also have, I believe you received the written testimony from the Board of Nursing at the time that Holly was up. You also have from the Medical Board, from the Physical Therapist Board of Dentistry, Occupational Therapist, and the Clinical Social Worker letter, the Oregon Vet Medical Association, all in opposition to the bill. You also have from the Board of Optometry, that opposes House Bill 2347 for the record, and I believe by email you got a document in opposition to 2347 from Rose Jane, as well as a verbatim transcript, but she wanted that part of today's record. So noted, Mr. Chair.
Were there any received testimony from boards in favor of either of those two?
Not that I have received before prior to the meeting, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Please.
No, I just wanted to recognize Dr. Darren Huddleston, who is the president of the Oregon Dental Board, who is a constituent of mine from Grants Pass. Anybody who comes from Grants Pass, it's a long drive.
Special right here. They're just here keeping an eye on you, I think.
Anyway.
Welcome. Thank you very much for being here. Anything else?
Yes.
Yes.
I missed one. A handout from Felicia Holgate on House Bill 2241 that just got was last minute.
2241.
Right. I didn't have a chance.
It's
against the bill.
Opposed.
She opposes the bill.
No, I don't think that's right.
That's not right.
Okay.
She doesn't oppose it.
They just would not raise, even if given the opportunity to go
so
above 30.
Neutral.
She would. I think they. Yeah, I think it's neutral.
They're
just pointing out that they wouldn't raise it.
I'm not sure that under this bill they have an option.
Yeah.
Maybe
under 2058 there is an option. I think under this bill there is not an option.
Right.
Okay.
So they would be required to raise it. Mm-hmm. We wouldn't hurt to find out why they don't want to raise it.
She's in their letter.
Some are paid, some are volunteers, some are state employees.
No, I read the letter.
Okay. Anything else?
All right.
It's Friday afternoon.
Well done, Mr.
Chair. 4:42, and we're adjourned.